So welcome to Series 5, Episode 2 of Conversation on Eagle Mountain, a podcast about the tribe. I'm your host, Lance, and joining the podcast panel today is Liz.
Hello.
Sabine.
Hi.
And Tamsin.
Hello.
With episode notes done by Matt and myself. So Series 5, Episode 2, the screenplay was done by David Fox. It was directed by Julian McSweeney. And the episode synopsis was read out by Sabine.
Ram's mysterious benefactor Slade makes an impression in the town of Liberty. Meanwhile, power cuts in the city lead to unrest, as paradise addicts demand their fix, whilst Trudy spills the beans about Ebony's disturbing visions of Zoot.
Alright, panel. So, we open with Amber and Trudy discussing Celine's kidnapping, while reflecting on their own experiences, only for Trudy to suddenly freak out as she sees Zoot. However, we quickly discover that she's just having a nightmare. So yeah, to kick things off, how did you react to the beginning of this episode?
I just really didn't know what to think at first. Like, one person going crazy and thinking she sees Zoot is one thing, but then for Trudy to see Zoot as well, before we find out it's a nightmare, it was just very odd. And in my case, it made me hopeful that it wasn't just a bad dream.
I thought the part with Trudy having the nightmare was fairly well done, because obviously it's going to be playing on her mind, and she's got so much trauma wrapped up in Zoot and the Chosen and all of that, that you can understand why she has this nightmare. However, for the dialogue that Amber then says to be almost identical to what she dreamt, I mean, what, is Trudy psychic now?
I think it's meant to make us think that it could have been real, you know?
Really?
It's meant to throw us off, I guess.
I liked it. I thought it was an interesting choice, though, to play it as completely straight. There's no indication that she's dreaming. Now, this can be good or bad, depending on your point of view, but I did think it was different from the way Ebony first saw him in season 4, where the lighting changed, the wind was blowing. It was very surreal and dreamlike when she first saw him. It was made very clear that it can't possibly be real what she's seeing, because even the atmosphere around her has changed. And season 5 is taking a whole different approach by making his appearances happen. There's nothing different about what's going on around the characters when they look and he's just staring at them in this very unnerving and eerie way, just hanging out in the room like a ghost, you know? And so, like, on one hand, I'm like, oh, okay, it feeds into the theme of everybody thinking Zoot returned in this season. And so can't tell the difference between real and unreal and blah, blah, blah. But it is an interesting, misleading choice, because it's not real, you know, it's so playing it like it's something that could possibly happen, that, you know, Amber walks in, everything, the lighting, everything is neutral and very realistic at the conversation that they're having. And then Trudy looks up and Zoot's just looking at her exactly the way he looked the day he died, you know, for the most part. It's like, okay, that's cool in one aspect, that she wouldn't have been able to tell she was dreaming because it was so real. But it does feel like a little bit of a trick on the audience, because it's trying to, I can't decide which way they should have handled it, because again, Zoot isn't real. This isn't actually happening. And they want to confuse the audience, as we know, as the plot goes along. They want to convince us that it must be happening. People are actually seeing him on and on. And I'm not sure that was the right choice, since again, it's a rug pull. He's not real. They're not actually seeing a real person. But I mean, I did like it though, but I'm just not sure how I feel about it overall, that when they see a vision of him, they've lost that mysterious element to it, because there's nothing to tell you this is a dream, you know. I can't tell if I like that or not.
Yeah. And I hear what you're saying there, and I agree with you. But I would also say, I think it just about gets away with it because of the context in which it's taking place in. So we know that he's on her mind. And so it just about gets away with all, like you say, with the rug pull that we know that this is going to be. It gets away with it because, of course, she's had this previously really disturbing conversation with Ebony. So it kind of makes sense that he's there on her mind, even if he isn't real.
Yeah, like, I don't have a problem with her seeing him. You know, like, that doesn't, I don't think that's weird that Trudy had a nightmare that there's Zoot. She just had this really messed up conversation. And Ebony was so convincing and so terrified. Mm-hmm. It scared Trudy into not wanting to turn around. Like, that's how scared she was listening to Ebony. Yeah. And so I'm not bothered by the fact that she has the nightmare at all. I'm just not sure how I feel about their choosing to film it. And film all his sightings so realistically for everybody who sees him, even though he's not there, you know. I don't know. I'm just, like, saying, like, it's something that kind of nicks in the back of my head when I see it. And I'm like, I like it, but I'm not sure if I like it because I don't know. It's stupid. Maybe I shouldn't have said anything, but I just noticed it.
For me, I think my biggest issue with it was mostly centered around the fact that they already have played their cards about what this is back in the end of season four. Like, they should have kept the mystery surrounding, okay, is this a vision? Is this a nightmare? Is this a dude? Is he coming back? Is he real? They should have kept that playing for the audience much longer. But now it said, we know, really know this is by Java and Mega's design. So it's like, well, so this is just doesn't really have much impact for me.
It does lean into something, though, we talked about, because I went back and I listened to the special that we did, and we talked about not real, real, and how we wished that there'd been a bit more of that in season four. Mm-hmm. I feel like psychically they listened to our podcast, and in the past they then went and put that into these episodes.
How do you mean? Because they really showed that it's not.
But I think until you get to that point in the episode when we get the reveal with Mega and Java, it is played as real, not real. And also, especially in the first episode.
I'll debate you there because... Sorry, go on.
No, I'm just going to say I agree with Tamsin because it isn't revealed that somebody human is behind this right away. You know, for two episodes, you still don't know why Ebony is seeing this. Is she losing her mind? And
is she on drugs?
Right, exactly. And it leaves you for two episodes thinking Ebony's going crazy. Because, like, Trudy having a nightmare about Zoot is a very realistic thing she could have, you know? And it's like, she doesn't see him in Ebony's room. She dreams about him. She wakes up screaming. It was clearly a dream. And it's like, oh, that's excusable. Of course, she'd have a nightmare about, you know, her ex-baby daddy, you know? And so I do think for the two episodes, they kept it a mystery. I agree that maybe could have kept it longer.
The problem is they showed the keyboard tapping right before Zoot was shown. So, I mean, so it immediately showed the audience that this is technology.
That was not every... Not everyone's going to make that connection, though.
It was pretty clear. Like, you saw the keyboard tapping, and then all of a sudden there was Zoot. Like,
but it was Ram's hand. It was his gloved hand.
It doesn't matter whose hand it was, but you can see it was being manipulated like straight away on the when he was introduced. So it's like, okay, well. And then, was it episode one? We saw Java and Mega talking. Like, it was pretty obvious like, that connection, that this was being forced up.
I don't know. I think that's ambiguous enough that it lets you know that something weird's going on, but you may not have made the connection that Zoot is the weird thing that's going on.
Yeah.
At that age, I didn't make that connection.
No, I didn't either. And I didn't, you know going into this, so obviously you make all those connections. But are we giving the writers too much credit by saying that they wanted those connections made?
Yeah, they weren't keeping it like a big mystery. It wasn't as big. It wasn't going to be a ghost. It wasn't going to be him coming back. So, I mean, it's not. They didn't play this big mystery.
Yeah, but I think what Tamsin's saying is that maybe they thought they were playing it as a mystery.
Like, that's what I think they were doing.
You know what I mean? Like, they thought. We've seen them think this before, like in their writing, yeah, where they thought, oh, they'll never get this. You know what I mean? It's like, dude, you guys, you know? So I think they think at this point in this episode that it's still, the audience still has no idea why Ebony is seeing him and hasn't made a connection that it's technology is the reason. Cause again, why would you make that connection given that they never, consider when Ebony got this dose of paradise, yes, they're going to pull out of their butt in season 5. And that's, yes, why she's seeing him. There was literally no hint and no time she could have gotten it. And so I think I'm with Tamsin. I believe the writers really believe they were forming a mystery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, okay. We'll agree, disagree on this then.
But yeah, I liked the opening. I don't know. There was something very natural. All the way down to, there were a lot of things I liked about this episode. I was like, Lance is going to hate me. I don't know how much of this is just bias because I love season 5 or if I'm actually noticing these things and think they're better. But
the only thing I genuinely liked about this opening was that they actually referenced that Amber and Trudy got kidnapped and have actually past history. Yeah. That was actually, wow, you actually remembered, mm-hmm, the past. But yeah, the rest of it, yeah.
But I actually only liked that a little bit because it completely negates that Trudy wouldn't have mentioned her own personal kidnapping, which is very similar to Celine's, where she was also, mm-hmm, alone from everybody and knows exactly, yep, how, yeah, Celine must feel when she goes, but we had each other, you know, she's all alone. It's like, so were you, Trudy. You know, and nobody was looking for you. You like, and they just completely gloss over what Trudy went through with the Chosen.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we can't have that because Ebony was the one who got her kidnapped.
Yeah, at least they mentioned one kidnapping attempt. You know what I mean? It's better than none. That's better than we've had in the past.
I guess it bugged me because they're going to keep making such a deal over, like in this season, they're going to bring it up several times that Trudy was with the Chosen, left the Chosen, had to reacclimate herself into her friends and family, her tribe and stuff like that. And it keeps getting thrown in her face by people in this season. Yeah, in this, mm-hmm, episode alone, Lex throws it in her face, you know, and it makes it, you know, and so I'm like, if you're going to make that such a plot point for Trudy, if you're going to remind the audience that this happened to her, then if you're bringing up kidnappings, maybe you should also mention that Trudy was also kidnapped. And I think the conversation should have included her saying, I really understand how Celine must be feeling because when the Chosen kidnapped me, you know, at least, mm-hmm, when you and I, like, you could easily have included her for, mm-hmm, like showing that kind of empathy for Celine's situation while also saying, and then of course, when you and I were kidnapped, we had each other. It sucked, but it was so much better than being alone. I know that from experience, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Mm. See the point you're making about the general series and how it's going to go on and how people treat Trudy, but for this moment and for this episode, I think it's fine, to be fair, but I get what you're saying.
We're not supposed to remember what happened to Trudy, only that she was bad and now she's still hoping to redeem herself, but we're not allowed to let her redeem herself.
Oh, I know. Trudy will never redeem herself. Here's Jay. He's one of us, but Trudy will never redeem herself.
Yeah, let's move over to our new area, Liberty.
Forget it. No vacancies.
No doubles.
No vacancies. Can't you read?
What's paradise?
Are you kidding me?
If you're talking about my friend out there, he's sick.
The people of Liberty are suspicious of paradise users and take an instant dislike to Slade, who they think is harboring an addict. They gang up on him in the bar and attack him, but he proves himself a capable fighter and impresses the saloon owner, Ruby. So yeah, we got a glimpse of him in episode 1. What did you make of this fuller introduction to our new characters and setting?
I really liked it, I've got to be honest. I think that out of all, we haven't had a lot of different locations introduced in the drive, but I think Liberty is introduced so well. It feels like somewhere that exists. It feels organic. It feels like it has its own persona. And it's nice to see them shading more of the map. It's nice to get outside of the city. And they dress a bit differently. They're all sort of country fried, you know, and they're different. And I really like that about Liberty. It's definitely got its own personality.
I love this introduction to this location and these characters. What I love, oh, there's so much. There's very little I don't like about it. I love that they seem to have learned their lesson. I'm wondering what the reaction was to the technos at the time from the fan base, what people were saying about it. Because my biggest problem with the techno introduction was that it didn't feel like the tribe. It did not feel like they existed in tribe world, the one we'd been living in for 3 years before they showed up. And they were just so jarring, and it was like, what, this whole show changed genres, you know? And with Liberty, while we're meeting new people and have a whole new location, it still feels like a place that exists in tribe world. It feels like a spinoff that's been happening this whole time. This place, the location, feels fully realized, where I had problems with the Gaians, where I liked like their introduction in season 3 and I liked the set design. Once you got inside like Amber's hut and looked at the furnishings and looked the way they behaved around their own architecture, it felt like, but I can't get an envision of how you live here. Where are the beds? Like, how do you live out here? It looks nice, but it doesn't look lived in. Liberty does, though. It feels like a place. It feels like a little suburb where Ruby took over the corner store, you know, and these kids have made this their home. This is where they have stayed out of the way of the city's goings on. And close enough that they know what's going on, but separated enough to just do their own thing and to be left alone and to have their own methodology of how they live out there. And not big enough to be important to anybody, but big enough to be able to survive amongst themselves. But it still feels like tribe world. Completely, you know, it doesn't feel like they're just made up some element to throw into tribe world and force it to fit. It's like, nah, this belongs here. This could have always been here. It's very easy to look at Liberty and imagine its evolution since the virus first happened.
Yeah, I agree. And I would also add to that as well. I would say that it's interesting. It also shows the way that they're so cautious and negative towards Paradise users. It shows how probably the effect that it's had, that the city, maybe people have come from the city or some stuff's gone down. And I think that's interesting because it feels, although it's a suburb, it's on the periphery of the city, what's happened in the city has still affected them.
It's kind of like Alice's Farm in that way.
Yeah.
Like within the same kind of vicinity from the city.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And in this season, Liberty will actually get the attention it deserves because where Alice's farm didn't always get that attention because it wasn't the main location, you get the sense Liberty, they really want it to be. We spend 50%, if not more, time in Liberty than we do like at the mall or in the city. They really liked this place. They wanted this to be the new main location. Everybody's finding an excuse to go to Liberty before the season is out. You know what I mean? Like, that's the new hub. That's our new central location. And so because of that, they never really drop the ball on how Liberty functions and lives and, you know, It everything about it just feels very believable that they have their own sense of their own currency and forms of trade and bartering and getting by and their own supply lines and on because it doesn't just remain some background location.
And I think, I mean, going to the characters that we see there. So obviously we see Ruby and she feels very organic to the place. She feels like she comes from there. The way she dresses. Pardon? Yeah, she belongs there. Yeah. And it feels so organic. And I think Sage fits into it really well. And it's a nice, he's got one of the best, I would say, two-part introductions that we've had in a long time.
That's another thing that stuck out to me in these first two episodes is the wardrobe and the aesthetic of the NPCs, the extras and stuff. Mm-hmm. This felt like the first time they've given them this much thought since season two. This is the closest I feel we're going to get to the aesthetic of season two, where the extras, there's so many details in what they're wearing, their accessories, their accoutrements, the distinctions between some of them. They feel like real people. Like somebody cared, someone in the costume department, someone in wardrobe really cared about and thought, oh, we can tell a story with what they're wearing. And it just felt more grounded, more, I could, more texture, you know, I could touch it. I could smell it. I could feel it. I could look at one of these, any one of these kids in the crowd and guess at their life. And you see all these little details on what they're wearing, the little items they've attached to themselves or to their faces and how they might identify as a group of people together. Because these guys all wear safety pins on their faces for some weird reason, you know, but that's their thing. That's what they do. And I'm like, I haven't seen that in a while because they've been pretty lazy for the last two seasons with dressing the NPCs. You know, they all kind of felt like season four, all the NPCs look the same. They all dress the same. You know, there's nothing really distinguishing them from each other. But I noticed it immediately season five started. I was like, somebody cared about these extras and what their wardrobe could say about them. Their hair and their makeup on everybody is pretty freaking impeccable. I don't know about you guys, but everybody looks like they got airbrushed.
I've got to be honest as well. I don't understand why he was able to get leverage on her like that, since they've got that sign above the door that says no paradise users. And he's like, oh, do you want him to die outside your business? And it'd be like, yeah, because then that kind of emphasizes the fact
that no paradise users are welcome here.
Exactly.
Why would I care that a paradise user died in front of my place?
It's so strange. It's like, oh, actually, though, when you say it like that, of course, welcome him in.
Yep. Like, I'm like, it's a pretty privilege. She's just not even hot on the spot. I don't blame her. He is beautiful to look at. But I think that's just an important thing to recognize about Ruby. Immediately, she saw him. She was like, that's hot. And she lets everything he does slide from then on.
Can we really blame her for that, though?
I'm just saying, like, people need to keep that in mind when they're assessing Ruby's character and she and Slade's relationship. It's not like there's a change that comes out of nowhere between Ruby and Slade's dynamic. It's there from the jump.
Yeah.
She immediately met her kryptonite as soon as he walked in. Whatever she had going for her, you know, steadfastness, strength that kept her... he unlocks it immediately when he walks in there. He gave her the smolder and she was done when it came to him.
Is it the accent? Is that what it was? She was
it's all package, honey.
You're from England.
He is such a perfect blend of Bray and Lex, I'm telling you. They finally found... And it's a shame, though, because it's like you could have just turned Lex into that. You had the goods there, you know? You had the story of Lex evolving into someone exactly like this. And instead they're like, that's too much work. We'll just create a whole new person to be that.
Yeah, because let's be honest. Lex is going to get completely squeezed out of the narrative now by Slade.
Even more, yes. Same.
But yeah, I think it looks amazing. I love this introduction to Liberty. Love this introduction to Slade and Ruby. And I'm like, I'm already invested in this place. You know, like I'm already on board with this new place we're visiting. Because I finally feel like I'm seeing a full realized corner of Tribe World.
Yeah. It's a shame that we didn't have more of this in the past. Like you say, we had the Guines and the Ecos, but as you said, that never felt as lived in as it could have been. And we have had this opportunity to have other areas of the city, but they've always missed the opportunity of actually giving it to us.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, but it's nice we're getting it now.
Because honestly, I haven't felt fully immersed in another location or another group of people we've been introduced to in the fringes of Tribe World or traveling through Tribe World since the Nomads in season one. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true. The Nomads in season one felt so lived in the way they conned people, scammed people, you know, forced friendship yeah. onto people and kindness so they could kidnap them and then sell them into slavery. They just felt real marching through this chaotic world. And that was a feeling Liberty gave me. Like, I fully believe that this exists here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's stuff to see out there in the city. It's every bit as good as that. And it's free.
You don't need power.
Like what?
Like a sunset, trees, shadows in the afternoon.
You sound just like Pride, always telling us to go out and do stuff. What does he know? He can't even rescue his girlfriend.
Paradise is gone. Snap out of it!
Later, the Morais discuss the power situation, with Amber believing that the city now expects it and that they should use the technology to spread their own message. But May disagrees. So yeah, all within this panel, what do you think about the power discussion and, of course, May's very rapid Series 5 evolution?
I was totally astounded by Amber when she said, at least they kept the power on, and the way that she is viewing the technos and mm-hmm. the technology. I don't know. I just think she's, after everything that they did to her, I mean, let's be honest. Okay, so they kidnapped her baby daddy, right? Young Damien's father, and they tortured her. She didn't know what was up, what was down. She had to go away and go to rehab. And she's come back and she's like, oh, well, you know, it was slightly better when they were. What is going on? Honestly.
Oh, yeah, that's just the magic of, you know, Jay.
Yeah. Is it the Jay thing, do you think, Sabine?
It's the magic of a new season, is what that is.
Who be fair?
Jay has magical skills.
She's not wrong in that the power being on prevents chaos.
Yes.
I like, but I think both Amber and May can be believable. Like, as a writer, looking at the way they're talking in this conversation, like Lance, I can see, like, it's not completely nonsensical that either of them would say what they say. Because, again, as a writer, I can literally write you up a synopsis as to how they got there and why they think this based on what's just happened in their past experiences. I can do that. But that doesn't mean that this sudden Amber just being like, oh, yeah, I don't seem to have any hard feelings about what these people have done to me and the damage they've caused. The fact that I nearly died in a barn because of these people, you know, and they took my child's father. I wandered the wilderness, you know, like Jesus for 40 days and 40 nights, you know, just because they took over my home and I had nowhere, you know, I'm trying to find a safe place for my kid. Mm-hmm. They kidnapped me. They tortured me. You know, last time I dealt with them, I wanted nothing to do with them or their technology. And I literally told you guys that. How do you get to a place where you're just like, well, you know, the one thing you can say about the techno is they kept the peace, you know, and you're like, how'd you get there? I do think it needed an explanation because it's not completely far-fetched that Amber and her experiences with dealing with power vacuums could be trying to go about things differently than they did with the Chosen. Because this is one thing you got to remember. Amber and Bray didn't want to deal with the Chosen fallout. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to imprison anybody. They just kept pretty much ignoring. They wanted to just hang out in their room and daydream about the family they were going to have. They didn't want to deal with what was very like happening outside their door and the riots and the confusion as to, well, what do we do with these people who, remember, the Chosen literally murdered people. It wasn't ambiguous like with the technos. It was, they murdered people. And then that was a bad experience for them. It went bad for Bray and Amber because they didn't want to face it. So you could argue that at this point, Amber is trying to approach this differently than last time, you know, and be more pragmatic about what's going on and how to deal with this, whether or not she personally likes it. Maybe she's more focused on keeping the peace because she knows what happens when you don't keep the peace. And you just try to force the change on everybody. May, same thing, but it's like both of them required an explanation. How do you go from 2 days ago, May, saying that you love living in this fantasy world because there you can be with Pride and you can rewrite your memories of what your relationship was like, to suddenly today being like, screw the techno, screw their tech, and we shouldn't let any of them go free, and da-da-da-da-da. Like, how do you get there? Could it be that she is had an epiphany? That, yeah, I can live in my fantasy with, you know, Pride, but at the end of the day, it doesn't change anything. He's in love with Celine, and the sooner I just face facts, the better off I'll be. But when did that epiphany happen? You know, like, they both just required more explanation, because the conclusions they come to aren't completely unreasonable. It's just like, how did you get there? What are you thinking? You know, and we don't get that, and I wish we had.
Yeah, I agree. I will say, though, I know that May, as you so eloquently said, Liz, you know, May's gone from one thing to another, being obsessed with Paradise to now sort of telling Sam, telling Sammy to go out and basically touch grass. But, but I will say, I have to say, May consistently is such a fascinating character in this series, because all of the directions you think she's going to go in, and this might just, it doesn't necessarily feel like bad writing. It feels like it's somebody who is actually alive. Does that make sense? Like, the things she does are not well thought through. And she was trying to step up to the plate, I think, in this conversation with Sammy. And she was trying to be a sort of Celine, Amber-type figure. And then when he started talking about Pride and Celine, she snapped. Because she wears her heart on her sleeve when it comes to this. And it felt, I know, not really realistic because of the conversation, but something in it felt realistic.
I agree with that. I like the use of Sammy. I thought that was, at least, you know, it's like, okay, you can't spend a ton of time with every Paradise user out in the streets and what's happening to them and how they've been affected by Paradise. So it's nice to make it a little small and focused by seeing Sammy just jonesing and losing his ish over this, and like a crack addict who needs his crack. And that's how he's behaving. Mm-hmm. And it like, it just personalizes what's happening everywhere. So that was at least a nice use of him, you know, and I agree what you say about May trying to step up, but this is, it's not like she's good at this sort of thing, you know, she's trying, you know, but she's human. She has her limits of how far she can be supportive before her personal stuff gets in the way. And that's realistic for her, you know, and it's not like it's the first time we've seen her do that, where she's been very gentle with someone 1 second, and the next she'd be like, oh, just get over it. You know? She's like, I have exhausted my limits of empathy, and you're whining. You got 5 minutes out of me. That's all I've got. That's all I can give you. And if that's not enough, go jump, you know, because I don't have any more to give you. But I don't like how everyone's talking as though the power has been on for so long they literally forgot how they lived without it. That's annoying. Like, when she's like, we can go outside and start a fire. I'll cook you a meal. I'm like, when have you guys done that? You literally cook on a gas stove in the mall. And you did that even before the tech news came. You've been doing that since you came to the mall. Why are you guys acting like you suddenly have to go forage and live in tents because the power's off? Give me a break. Stop. You guys have been glamping. You were glamping the whole time before the techno showed up. So to act as though they have to go live like the Gaian suddenly because there's no power. I'm like, guys, stop it.
Let's not forget about that amazing spread that they put on back in season 3, where they had popcorn and cakes and bags of crisps, all without power.
Yeah.
Yep.
They were clearly, they had learned to live without power. Now, granted, yes, who doesn't want the power to stay on? But stop acting like these guys have completely forgotten. Because that's not Sammy's problem. He hasn't forgotten how to eat food. You know what I mean? He just wants to live in a fantasy world. He hasn't forgotten that he can still take a bath. He just doesn't want to. You know, there's a difference between becoming dependent on the electricity for your daily tasks. That's not what these paradise users are holding on to it for. It's not because they've forgotten how to live. It's that they just like living there with the headsets better. So I just thought that was weird the way she's talking to him. And I'm like, give me a break. This is not how you guys were living before the technos showed up. They act like these kids weren't playing video games. They weren't looking at sunsets. They were just trying to find other ways to recreate the convenience of the technologies they had grown up with and known their own lives. And were doing pretty okay. They were printing. Clearly, they have a great Photoshop in this place. That was not hindered by the end of the world at all. All right. These guys are printing massive posters to put up in the city. Like they were doing, they're still making their alcohol. They're like, it's just like, come on, you guys, you were doing okay. Like without the electricity, it was convenient, but that's not why the paradise users are losing their minds right now.
Which is still hilarious that they could print all those pictures and posters.
I know.
Yeah.
Without power.
They're like, wait, we got battery stuff. We've been doing it since season one, figuring out how to have power to do the most important things. You know, they behaved like people during a power outage who have to depend on their generator. Like, okay, you have to parse out what you use the generator for. Can't use it for everything in the house, but you keep your fridge going. You might use your stove, you know, things like that. You might use a few lights in the house with your generator. That's how they lived. They found ways to make power. And then used it accordingly to the most important thing they needed the power for. Now, if Sammy was like, I don't want to use the toilet because the water went out. Like, I don't want to go back to using a bucket every time I have to use the bathroom, right? Again, that's an aggression. That's a regression you don't want to do. Forget it.
Just a sudden thought I had, could be completely wrong, but do you think maybe this was meant to be Celine? Do you think it was supposed to be Celine who was speaking to Sammy and then have this conversation with Amber about the power, but then they had to suddenly write Nick Miller off, so she had to be kidnapped?
Well, that's interesting perspective.
Possible, because I did think it was a little weird that Mouse had gone to May, but I figured if she's the only one in the vicinity and Mouse is desperate to help her friend, you know, but I can see that. Maybe originally it was supposed to be Celine. It would make perfect sense for Celine to be the one that Mouse goes to and who tries to talk to Sammy or whatever. But I don't think there's anything really lost, to be honest.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Given how Celine mothered the children in season four anyway, like it works just as fine with May.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's typical, though. I mean, first we see Mouse instantly latch on to Amber, and now that Amber and Trudy are within this building, she goes to May? I don't know, it just felt odd.
I mean, I guess Mouse is of that age, isn't she? Where she will latch on to grown-up people, because she's a child, isn't she? And maybe...
But why not Siva?
Well, I mean, there you go, why not Siva? Why not Siva? They use her so infrequently.
Mm-hmm.
And they had built that nice relationship between Siva and Mouse. But to be honest, it could have been, I mean, you could have had Mouse going to Siva and May, who are having a conversation. You know, it's they just don't use the characters they've got very well, do they?
Unless he went to May because May might be able to understand what Sammy's going through.
Yeah, exactly. Then make that clear. Kind of give some thought behind why Mouse did that.
And why not Bride? Because Bride's responses can be explosive.
Because she realizes that her abusive father is unpredictable. That's what she's learned about him. Was like, you know what? No, I'm not going to him. Because, May was addicted, but you didn't see her losing her mind on everybody all the time, like Pride. Yeah. So if I were Mouse, I wouldn't be going to Pride.
And I mean, there are only three people that will really understand this. As you said, like, Pride will understand it, Amber will understand it, May will understand it and Lex will understand it. But as you said, she's probably not going to go to Pride because, like, he is abusive. Lex is nowhere to be seen. And
Amber doesn't do children.
Yeah, he doesn't do kids. But also, like, you can't... They're never going to give us the conversation like that again, ever, with Lex. He's never going to have a conversation like that with Mace.
What?
Ebony, she told me about Zoot.
Trudy!
They care about you. I don't know why, since you hate them so much, but they do. And so do I.
She had no right. Besides, I've got a beat.
I want to help.
You can't. Not with this.
Why not? We've all been through a bad time.
This is different.
Why?
This isn't in my head. This is real.
So yeah, what did you make of Ebony's mental state and her secret being revealed?
Well, Ebony's all over the place, isn't she? And that's understandable. And I think it's coming at her from lots of different sides. So she's got the paranoia about Amber and Jay, because they're clearly, I mean, we all know that there's something going on between them, right?
Yeah, it's a paranoia if it's real.
It's not paranoia if it's real. It's real. And she's also got them twisting her melon over Zoot. So I thought it was really well done, because in one scene you had Meryl basically attacking Amber and Jay verbally. And then the next moment she breaks down in front of Jay and is begging him not to leave her. And it's kind of seamless. It felt like you believe mm-hmm. that this is somebody in such a state of she is losing her mind. She's gone mad. And that's how she's acting.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really well done.
Agreed. I think Ebony makes the most sense in all of this. I think she's performing it incredibly well, especially when you take, just look, go back to the other episode and look at the mm-hmm. scene between her and Trudy. Now, the way it's filmed, it's like a horror movie. It's mm. J-horror at its best, okay? Yeah. The way she's sitting there telling Trudy, you don't see him, and then the camera pans to what she's seeing, and it's just Zoot eerily just hanging out in a room staring mm. at her. Like, that is horrifying. Like, it gave me chills. Like, oh my, how do you relax? How do you ever relax mm. when at any moment you can look up? And, like, before, you know, it was kind of like, it wasn't happening all the time. You know, she would just find herself alone. Things would feel weird. She'd look up and there he would kind of appear at a distance, you know, and then disappear, you know. But now she's in her bedroom and he's just chilling at the foot of her bed. Like, that is terrifying. Okay. So her unwinding, she's doing it very well, very well, trying to maintain, like, what is happening to me? Why am I seeing my abusive ex-boyfriend? You know, like, what is going on? And I thought, you know, Trudy, the way she spills the beans, it was very Trudy, you know, not wanting to break someone's confidence, but it unnerved her. It makes sense because of the way they filmed the scene with her and Ebony. It scared the crap out of Trudy to the point she's dreaming about it herself and wants to talk about it, you know. And I thought that conversation between her and Amber was great. It was really well acted between the friends. It felt very natural, you know, and I even like the dun, dun, dun when Amber's like, believe me, Trudy, Zoot's not coming back. You know what I mean? Like, it had a very nice, ominous feel to it. Mm-hmm. Like, but what I hate is the way Jay and Amber are so condescendingly looking down at Ebony's suspicions of them and treating her like there's no reason for her to have them when they know they kissed. Yeah. They know they kissed. And neither of them show an ounce of guilt or even confusion over why that happened. Like, it's disgusting. Like, Jay, we already know, is a disgusting human being who doesn't feel guilt because he's a freaking sociopath. So why would he ever make the connection that, oh, I did kiss Amber. I went to her. I dragged her out of her home. changed plans with my girlfriend and needed Amber to be there for. I know exactly what I'm doing. I don't expect him to make the connection that it's obvious to Ebony what's going on with him. But Amber, I do expect more out of you to feel at least and show a semblance of guilt when Ebony is in your face accusing you of messing around with her boyfriend when you know for a fact you already have messed around with her boyfriend. She's not crazy.
To be fair, I cannot believe I'm defending Amber in this, but to be fair, after what Ebony did to her,
I'm
her for not feeling guilty for, you know, doing this to Ebony.
Yeah, I mean.
Okay, and I agree with you there, but they never played it like that. That's the problem. They never wanted to give Amber that point of view where, she messed around with Jay because who gives a crap what Ebony thinks? Because Ebony deserves it from Amber's point of view. And she'd be righteous in that belief. But they have never played it that way. They've never wanted to play it that that's what Amber is doing. So her being this condescending to Ebony sickens me. Where she's acting like Ebony's accusations are literally coming out of nowhere, despite the finale where she literally tells her, I kind of like him, but I'm not going after him. You know, you've confessed to this woman that you think her boyfriend's hot and that you're interested in him. And you're like giving her this scoff when she accuses you to, when you're constantly running off together, you know? Like, it pisses me off because I know it's the narrative. It's the narrative trying to paint Jay and Amber as innocent and Ebony's the one blowing up the relationship because she's so paranoid and crazy. And it's just like, are you friggin' kidding me? I mean, it's like, even if Amber is looking down at Ebony, she and Jay should at least have a moment where they discuss this. There should be some self-awareness there, but there's zero. They both act like innocent puppies who are like, oh my gosh, Ebony, why are you acting so crazy when they both know what they did?
And to be honest, I would have liked to have seen that scene because I would like to see them discuss it and not sweep it under, because that's what we need. So we've gone into this and it feels like this is part B of watching these two episodes, what it felt like to me is, you know, when you've got a season or a series and they break it into two parts, this feels like the second part of season four. And it feels like a lot of this they're expecting the audience to actually remember. We do, because we saw it a couple of months ago, right? Whereas you've got to think it was a year later for all of us when we watched this the first time. And I just feel like we're missing some conversations here. And one of the key ones, as you said, is Amber and Jay talking about the kiss.
I just want to know, because I don't know what either of these two feel about that moment.
Yeah.
Do either of them think it was simply a mistake? How do they rationalize what happened between them at the Gaian camp? Why it happened, like what they were thinking. Was it just a momentary slip of attraction? You know, do they feel a pull? Neither one of them discussed on their own or with anybody or each other what happened. Why did we kiss? What did that mean? How do we feel about the kiss? Even a moment where, you know, Amber tells him, or EJ tells her, because he's trying to cover his tracks, sorry about what happened. You know what I mean? I don't know what was going on. I just felt vulnerable in that moment. You made me feel safe, blah, blah, blah. But we don't know how either of them feel. It's like the kiss never happened and Ebony's just out of her mind.
Yeah. And I mean, I've got to say as well that this is something they're going to pick up for the rest of the season when it comes to this couple. This is the narrative that's going to play out because they don't want them to look bad ever. So they won't have any conversations about anything and things will then just happen. But you're right. Jay acts like a sociopath and it's just not wanting to make him look bad is the worst thing that they could do.
Yeah. Yep. And it sickens me seeing them both look at her like that.
Yeah.
And it's of course, as you said, Tamsin, there are plenty of people in the audience who may have forgotten or even missed that they kissed in the first place and do see Ebony as just being crazy. And it's like, why aren't they talking about this? Do you need, and again, if you want to establish that neither of them feel guilty about it, fine. Establish that. Again, I will give Amber a pass if she doesn't feel guilty about it completely, you know? But you got to address that it happened and let us know how both of them view it as what happened, you know? Like, whether they wrote it off or whether they're, you know, they wonder why it happened, you know, just anything, but pretending it didn't when that's literally going to be the plot, these two railroading everybody they encounter on their road to togetherness. Come on, you can't ignore it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's interesting as well that Amber tells Jay what's going on with Ebony. I think that's interesting because I think that tells you a bit about, I don't think there are bad intentions in this. Maybe that's just, I don't think she's got bad intentions in telling him. I think it shows you the character that Amber is. Because even after everything that Ebony has done to her, when it comes down to it, Amber had her back in this moment and she told her boyfriend that Trudy had told her what Ebony had told her, and this is what's going on. This is the deal. And I think that's really interesting because Amber's still in there.
Yeah, I don't think there's any bad intentions either, but I do think this is also evidence of their wishy-washiness with Amber's character. She's, you're going to see in this season, Amber having more grace for Ebony than her own best friend. Like, Amber flip-flops between genuinely wanting Ebony and Jay to work out. Why? Why should she care if Ebony is happy? Like, and yet, when it came to Trudy, this same woman lashed out, accused Trudy of said some of the most horrible things to her over this same guy. Over the same guy. She is willing to, like, attribute Ebony's behavior. She's, like, willing to be gracious about it and consider what's fueling Ebony's behavior. She's looking out for Ebony's well-being and didn't have that grace for her best friend. Like, it's like the writers, it's only here so that Amber looks innocent. That's what it ends up feeling like. It's very weird choice to have her be this gracious and be like, Ebony, I don't want your man. You know what I mean? You don't have to try to kill me over him. You know, I want you guys to be happy. I'm looking for Bray, on and on, you know, and Jay, look, you need to know this about your girlfriend. You should be concerned because she's seeing things that she shouldn't be seeing. She's seeing a dead man, okay? And she seems pretty freaking scared about it. And I don't know what that means, but you should know. All of that coming from such a good, gracious place. Yes, Ebony, you're welcome among us egos and all that. And no, there's no real hard feelings considering all the horrific crap you've been doing to me since the day we met. And yet the same Amber is going to back over her friend several times. And it's like, what did the writers want with her character?
Nope, we're not going there yet.
No.
So when I see this, I'm suspicious because I know what comes next. And I'm like, what is the motivation between telling Jay this? Because it can't be just that you're a nice person. It can't just be that.
Well,
and again, I don't blame her. I blame the writers because I'm like, I don't think they know what they're going for.
It feels like Amber's going to get sacrificed on the rock of Jay. Let's be honest. Her character is going to get done over so that he doesn't get any flack.
Yeah.
I mean, the same thing happened in season 4. She was sacrificed so that Ebony could look good and all her sins were kind of whitewashed. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's just part of the course at the moment for Amber.
It's so unfair because Amber is such an interesting character and she's been through so much. And really, she gets, like, we talk a lot about Lex getting shunted. But Amber, even though it feels like she's now fully on board in season 5 going forward, we're going to get Amber back again almost full time, right? It feels like, as you've said, Liz, the writers don't know what to do with her character. So, as you said, Lance, she was sacrificed to make Ebony look good. She's going to get sacrificed to make Jay look good. He's so amazing. Of course, she's going to ruin her friendship with Trudy. And It just feels like she's an interesting character. Why are you not doing anything with her apart from giving her these sort of this awful romance that nobody wants?
I'm not looking forward to that.
No.
I just can't yet.
No. It's just really sad.
But yeah, that brings us to our final thoughts of the episode. With Amber uncovering a farewell note from Dee and Patch, Tai-San is the only Morat left unaccounted for. Desperate to find her, to receive his frustration, Lex confronts Mega, who tells him he understands his concern, showing him a photograph of somebody he claims to have lost. When Lex leaves, however, he quickly deletes Tai-San's data from the system. So yeah, panel, what did you make of the in-world explanations for these characters being missing, including the hint that Mega has just gotten rid of Tai-San?
So we talked about a lot in season 4, the lack of urgency that a lot of the characters had around their loved ones disappearing. And it feels like, again, there's a lack of urgency because we know that Celine has been kidnapped. We know that people are starting to disappear again the way they did in season 4. Mm-hmm. And people are like, oh, well, Dee and Patch are probably just hooking up somewhere. And there's no sense of urgency. And I also want to say that letter that Dee left, oh my God, talk about saying, mm-hmm. no, we've got Jack and Ellie back now. You two can leave.
Yep.
It's such a bad serve for two characters. I mean, we all said in our roundup how much we like Dee and Patch. And a lot of the time, they didn't do much with them, but the little amount they did do was okay, and they were great new additions to the cast. And this just feels like, oh no, we don't need you anymore. We've got that coming. They're coming, so we've got to get rid of you now. And we don't know what was going in the background for like either of the actors to leave, but it just feels like surely, if you got a sense that they wanted to leave, or there were issues in season 4, and for whatever reason people wanted to go back home or whatever, surely you could have done a little bit of a scene where you essentially wrote them out without writing them out. It made it clear that they might have been going. But as it is, it feels...
Even just showing them with some backpacks would have...
Yeah!
I think these disappearances are pretty lazy, and that's saying something because, like, okay, season 4, yes, it was chaotic, all these people disappearing, but at least you could say that the writers found themselves backed against a wall with half the cast gone, you know what I mean? They had to come up with a reason why half the cast is gone, but at least you had the chaos of an invasion to explain it away, you know what I mean? Like, okay, you could be like, yeah, you know, they... either went out into the city and got captured by Technos, or we know Technos came into the mall. They nearly caught Chloe. Maybe that's where they found Alice hanging out still by the cage, crying over Ned and thinking she killed the Guardian. Maybe that's where they grabbed her, you know, or whatever. But at least you had that. There was chaos that could explain how these people could just disappear without anyone witnessing what happened to them and not having a firm idea of what happened. I never really bought these people disappearing in season 5 when there was no chaos. There was no battle with the Technos. Like, according to Mega, what we're told both at the season finale of 4 and season premiere of 5, that what happened was that the Mallrats were able to just literally walk in. The few Technos who did try to stop them, their lasers were disarmed. And that was it. There wasn't any fight. There wasn't anything crazy going on. So to just easily lose sight of some of the most important people in your group who were all there, I do not believe Lex let Tai-San out of his sight. I don't. Given that last shot of them standing together, I don't buy that she was able to wander off even to go to the bathroom without being like, okay, I'll guard the door. You know what I mean? There's no way she just wandered off. And he didn't see where she went. I don't believe that Celine also just disappeared. Remember, she and Pride are engaged now. When did she disappear and he didn't notice?
Yep.
Not to mention, she disappeared before those two Technos got the idea to kidnap her. So where the frick was she before they were able to kidnap her? When did Patch and Dee just leave the room and no one noticed in this calm environment that was happening? It was a very calm environment. You know, also, this is what I think is hilarious. Yeah. Patch, they don't say goodbye because Patch doesn't like goodbyes. I beg to differ. Patch literally took you back to the wrecking crew so he could tell three little boys, I'm abandoning you because my brothers aren't here anymore. I don't think Patch has a problem with goodbyes. I really don't. I don't think he has a problem saying bye, y'all. You shouldn't have. Maybe you shouldn't have filmed him doing that.
Exactly. Maybe it's like young children.
Maybe you shouldn't have included that scene where he abandoned a bunch of prepubescent children who have been in his care this whole time without a second thought, and then try to pull the Patch doesn't like goodbyes. No, that's BS. I'm calling it. Calling total BS. I would have bought it if Dee was like, and we didn't like you guys that much, so...
We're done with all the drama.
Yeah, you guys suck, and we don't want to be a part of what's about to happen next.
And now you guys are adding babies to the mole? Yeah, nope.
And I agree with Tamsin that they were far too cavalier about these characters not being able to count for where they went. They were way too calm. Like, for once, Pride had the right reaction to Celine not being, no one knowing who she was and being like, what the frick? This isn't normal, guys. Why would Celine do that? Why would she wander off without telling anybody where she went and nobody has seen her? And everybody, including Amber, is just like, I'm sure they're just doing this, you know?
Sorry, my brain is suddenly going, well, the rest of them have realized what a prick you are, Pride. So they get it that Celine's not here.
That would be funny. But, you know. But, yeah. Did you kill her, Pride?
Did you kill her?
What did you do to Celine? And then he could give us the whole, I didn't do anything. Are you kidding me? I love her. I'm going to marry her. Just, you know, that would be a hilarious argument. But, yeah, I'm like, have you guys learned nothing? It hasn't been that long since the techno invasion where half of the people you know and love were snatched. So why are you so calm in this moment of regime change when people just disappear and you're just making excuses for why? Like, I mean, the guys are literally saying we need to sound the alarm. Something isn't right. And Amber's just like, well, we don't need to jump the gun. Are you serious, Amber? We don't need to jump the gun? What this is where I hate the writing of her character, where I can give her an excuse for maybe trying to handle this power vacuum differently than she did last time. That shows some growth. I can't do the same thing because the last thing I did didn't work. It ended badly for everyone I know. So let's try this. Right, including her. So let's try something different. But why does she have to be so cavalier about everything that's happening around her? Like, she's so disinterested in everything. And it's just so calm and no alarm bells go off in her head at anything she's been told in these last two episodes. Nothing has set off an alarm bell in Amber's head.
No, because now she has Che near her and the whole world is unicorns and rainbows.
It's just weird how calm she is about everything, including more of her friends not being accounted for just after they took down the techno leader and are imprisoning technos. And you don't...
Yeah. It's almost as if she has read the script.
This is what I'm saying. This is where the acting comes into play. I feel like Beth was one of the first people who read the script and said, okay, you know what? This doesn't need my 100% and I'm not giving it. And it's okay. She's such a good actress. She doesn't have to give 100%. You know what I mean? But that was one of the first things I noticed was in Amber's acting. Obviously, other people will join her in the I don't give an F anymore about this. Because it's ridiculous. But hers is the first one where she was just like, yeah, this doesn't deserve all of my attention. And I'm just enjoying this last season of summer camp with these people I grew up with. Gonna have fun with them. But I'm not all that invested in what this plot is because it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I just want to say, I knew Tyson wasn't coming back. I was still sad. I know she's off at this point doing Neighbours, though she's not coming back. but I was still quite sad about it. But the other side of me is like, I'm glad she's not returned. Because can you imagine what they would have done to her character?
That scene with Mega annoyed me the first time I saw it because I was like, wait, what? What was the point of bringing her back? Now, obviously, later years, I realized, oh, they never intended to keep her around. Yeah. And she was just the bait to get us to come back to this season. Mm. It was good bait. I won't deny it. It was great bait. I wanted to know. Yeah. I wanted to see what happened between her, Lex, and Siva. You know, it was amazing bait, but I didn't like the bait and switch. It pissed me off so much. And it's even worse that there will never be an explanation as to what was going on with Mega and Tyson.
No, because I don't think we're going to get one. No. When we do the books.
Like, there's no explanation for the rest of the season as to why he is so gleeful to be deleting her file and whatever the frick that's supposed to mean. It means nothing in this world. And I'm like, what was the whole situation between the two of you? Because again, season 4 didn't explain it, you know, and season 5 is just like, she's gone. They just want you to know she's gone. She's not coming back. And it's just pissed me off so much. Like, of all the jingled keys I've ever seen, this one pissed me off the most.
Yeah.
I was like, that was such a bait and switch, and it was cheap. And it's like, that's why I came back, man. That's why I wanted to see if you could do it better this time. And you immediately kicked me in the teeth.
Mm. I also want to say, like, okay, so we get two photographs in that scene as well. So the first one I thought was quite interesting because that photo that he hands to Lex, that's a Mozzie. If you notice the makeup, mm-hmm. which we've been talking about hair and makeup and the fact that the extras filmed distinct. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Obviously, maybe that's the makeup, a still from a makeup shoot that they did with, like a makeup test that they did with one of the Mozzies at one point, and they've used that. So I thought that was interesting. And the other thing that I couldn't get my head around was why have they used a photo of Tyson when she was with the Chosen, when she was captured by the Chosen? Like, why would they have that on file? Why wouldn't they just have her when she was a Techno? How could they have got that photo of her?
The Guardian knew them.
They got those promo shots, man. They gotta use them, you know?
It's like the Guardian knew of their existence, so he must have tried to show off his new wife.
I hate this moment with Lex and Mega so much. I'm just glad that this isn't Mega's like motivations. Like, I'm so glad, because I don't think his character would have worked out as well if he had the same lame motivation as Jay, but only half-heartedly done. Because, like, and I'm blown away how easily any one of these characters, every single one of these characters, is won over by someone they don't trust, won over by someone who's done horrible things to them, by just hearing a lazy, run-of-the-mill, I've lost someone to storyline. And immediately we're on the same page. Oh, you understand my pain? Mm. And it's like, you guys are living in the apocalypse that killed every adult on the planet. Everyone has lost somebody. Yeah. This is not a unique story, okay? And as dumb as like Jay's is, at least they gave it a flashback. They went into some detail of how this shaped him, not being able to save her with precious antibiotics that just weren't around. And that's why he wanted to join up with these Techno people, so that would never happen again. Megas is like, I just keep this picture on file for dumbasses like you, Lex. I lost this random girl, even though I'm completely asexual, and so I get how you're feeling. And Lex is immediately like, I just need to find her, man. I'm not even mad at you anymore, because you know what I feel. I'm like, stop doing this! What is wrong with you guys?
Yeah. Honestly, it's beyond a joke at this point. You're spot on.
Like, I like Mega doing it, though.
Well, yeah, because it feels... What we come to know about Mega later on is this, he's just doing this and giggles, let's be honest.
You know? Like the bare minimum of him pretending to be a human. The bare minimum.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. He actually is enjoying the act of pretending to be a human. But I mean, okay, let's talk about Lex's IQ, because what happened to him? It was quite low in season 4, but has he had a head injury? Was it when those people attacked him and they gave him a concussion and he walked in there? Because we know season 1 Lex wouldn't have bought this for a second. He would have been, as you said, Liz, like, play me another tune on your violin, okay, because we've all been there, hun, right? But the thing is, like, now he's like, oh, yeah, you do understand. Oh, I get it. You know, we're all in the boat together. It's like, no, literally, where is my wife? You two were as thick as thieves. If anybody knows where she is, you will know where she is. And also another thing, why were you waiting for me in that control room? Because that feels suspicious, like almost as if you were trying to stop me from looking at something or trying to find something on the, you know, like none of this adds up. And the Lex previously, before season 4, would have connected the dots. But he doesn't, because he's got a traumatic brain injury.
I wonder if it's just Lex's misogyny or the misogyny of the show in general. Because remember, this is the same Lex who has zero empathy for any female who has gone through a rough time. Like, none. Like, Trudy, he's never going to stop giving it to her when it comes to The Chosen. Ever.
Well, he does it in this episode.
Right. Exactly. And it's like, he will never let that slide. He'll never let May's actions slide. You know what I mean? He will but Mega can just be like, here's a photo of a female that I was also attached to.
Yeah.
As humans are ought to do from time to time. And Lex immediately melts. And all the anger fades away. Oh, another man understands when penis is empty? You know what I mean? Like, he and I'm like, is this just blatant misogyny or just Lex's misogyny? I don't know. It's weird.
It's hard to tell, isn't it? Because, like, we know this show is incredibly misogynistic, but we also know so is Lex.
Like, Lex will start a bromance with a bunch of men who have done him wrong, done his people wrong. And he's just like, we cool, we buds now. But any female who does something wrong. And I'm just like, is this just the show or is this Lex? Because we know Lex's character doesn't exist anymore anyway, despite the fact that they at least gave Caleb a chance to act in these two episodes. And he seemed so eager to do it. He was so happy to be acting. And but yeah, it was just, I was like, why do you guys keep pulling this tired storyline? I'm so sick of hearing that I lost everyone I love and that's why I'm a scumbag. And the other person going, I get it. I get it. Like, no, we all lost everyone we love. Are you kidding me? It's not an excuse.
And these boys are just going like, oh, samesies.
This is it's a terrible premiere comparatively to all of them. It's bad. I had fun with it. I don't know what to tell you.
Look, we've all got our guilty
pleasures. Episode 1 was bad, but you know, I liked, I will agree, it is the worst opener. Like both episodes together, you know, compared to the excitement of season 4, you know, as much as I didn't like it, as much as I was jarring by like the technos and stuff, it's still a good premiere. You know, and sets up a really good mystery for the new bad guys. And, you know, season 3, The Chosen of One, and you have to sit with that dread in your stomach. Season 2 is exciting and heartbreaking all at once. Like, why? And now we have a mission? Like, can we not sit with our feelings? No, we have to save the world and ourselves, you know? And nothing tops season 1, as far as I'm concerned. But I guess I just like season 5 so much. I was like, yay!
All right, cool. That brings Series 5, Episode 2, to a close. Thank you very much to the panel, and we'll see you next time for Episode 3. So until then, bye.
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 Bye.